Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So let's start out with yet another reason to love vitamin D and avoid statins if you can. Some recent guidelines, this story came out a few months ago, questioned the utility of vitamin D for prevention, and especially vitamin D supplementation outside select populations. I already went on record as to why I disagreed with that. Now, a recently published study has found some more evidence that, you know, it's if you look under the right rock, you might find some good things about vitamin D if you deliberately set up a study that is either for too short a duration or using too low a dose, you're probably not going to find anything. But then, of course, you pick that rock on purpose. There is a real animus against supplementation and I think most doctors with a bit of, us old school types who actually think for ourselves have often shown me the science. So I'm about to, doctors, nurses, and public, I'm about to show you some science. Now, a recent study used data from the VITAL trial, and that was a very large database. And this was a five-year study over 2,500 adults in the United States who took 2,000 international units of vitamin D a day with 1 gram of marine omega-3 fatty acid, that's to say fish oil, for 5 years. And they monitored a bunch of things on them. And depends on what data you look and what rock you look under. But there were lots of pebbles in this study. We're going to turn over one of the ones that showed some very interesting things about vitamin D. Spoiler alert, vitamin D, moderate amount daily, very safe levels, prevents shortening of telomeres in immune cells, delaying immunosenescence, and potentially turning back the biological clock on aging by the equivalent of 3 years. Now, this is probably not just immune cells. It's just that, hey, when you look in the blood, you know what you find? You find immune cells. They are the easiest cells to look for. And while there's more red blood cells, the red blood cells are, well, they don't have nuclei, so you won't be able to look at telomeres in red blood cells. That's a very good reason to probably look somewhere else. Telomeres are often described as like the little plastic things you have on your shoelaces that keep the woven fabric of the shoelace from unraveling. And, you know, anyone who's worked with rope knows that you have to bind the end of the rope, otherwise it unravels. Well, now let's consider the chromosomes as ropes and the telomeres as basically a plastic end cap on the chromosomes that keeps them from unraveling, and DNA being a very, very relatively fragile thing. If it unravels, it's going to get broken and chopped off, and you're going to start to lose important information, shall we say. So the telomeres are unimportant information, but an important protective thing on the tips of your chromosomes. And as we age, our telomeres shorten. And research, really groundbreaking research done on stress and telomere length. This data has to be 10 or 20 years old. It was done a long time ago, but it was extremely interesting. It looked at women who were caregivers for disabled adult children. So that's and another study later on did women who were taking care of children with malignancies who weren't adults, but who were children. And Both studies showed that the telomeres on this group were much shorter than age-matched controls who didn't have chronic daily caregiver stress, which is probably, when you're certainly a mother dealing with her child, one of the more intense forms of caregiver stress there can be. Because your kids aren't supposed to die before you do. That's in the rule book somehow. As we make that leap, that courageous leap of having children, well, there's a reason that there's a connection, and it's important for our biology, but it also means that we're very, very vulnerable to what happens to our kids. So it makes sense that the telomeres would be shorter. Chronic stress of all kinds will do that. In this sub-cohort of the vital study, they looked only at people who were evaluated in person at the Harvard Clinical and Translational Science Center. That was a subgroup. And there they were looking at leukocyte telomere length, so your white blood cell telomeres. And they had a baseline data, and then they put people on the vitamin D and the omega-3 fatty acids, and then 2 and then 4 years later, after daily use of these supplements, they reanalyzed them. Overall, they did about 2,500 samples, and what the results showed is very interesting. Those who got 2,000 units of vitamin D daily showed much less telomere shortening. Remember, I said this is an inevitable aging thing. Much less shortening than those who took placebo, both at 2 years follow-up, but especially after 4 years. Their shortening of their telomeres was actually minimal, while the normal control group had significant shortening at both time points. But specifically, it decreased the attrition on the telomeres by about 14.14 kilobases over 4 years. That is statistically significant. And the authors did some calculations. That's 140 base pairs that were not lost. And that would be about the amount that you would expect to lose in 3 years. So at the 4 year mark, people had aged one quarter of the amount off of their telomeres. Now, that 1,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids did not have a significant impact on telomere shortening, but it didn't interfere with the impact of telomere shortening, and it did show some benefits. I'll get to those in a minute, but we're going to stay on vitamin D for the sake of clarity. And this is really interesting. The authors noted that for those people who were taking cholesterol-lowering medications, that is to say statins, the vitamin D did not work. It did not have a significant impact on their telomere length. And for patients who were obese, they also did not get the protective effect from the vitamin D. And that may be because it got sequestered in their fat and wasn't available in their other body tissues, such as the bloodstream. Hard to say. That's a speculation on my part. They also found that that dose, 2,000 IU of vitamin D, reduced the incidence of advanced, that is to say metastatic or fatal cancers, by 17%. And they also showed that those who took vitamin D with or without the omega-3s for 5 years reduced all incident autoimmune diseases by 22%. That's almost a quarter of the autoimmune diseases that happened in the control group didn't happen in the treatment group. Another vital study by the same group found that the vitamin D, with or without the omegas, decreased circulating high C-sensitivity C-reactive protein by 20% at year two. This is really important as well, also a significant finding, but inflammation plus high cholesterol is what you need to not get a heart attack. I mean, if you've got high cholesterol with no inflammation, you'll be okay. The problem is it's very hard to avoid inflammation some of the time. And once the inflammatory process gets rolling in the blood vessels, the actual act of grabbing the cholesterol is itself pro-inflammatory. Another reason that diabetics, type 2s or type 1s, have more heart disease, and in fact, in type 2 diabetes, if you are, let's say your fate is to have a heart attack at the age of 64, if you're a poorly controlled diabetic with high insulin levels, you're going to get it at 54 or even younger. Vitamin D is known for its anti-proliferative, anti-inflammatory, and apoptotic. That last one you may not know. Apoptosis is when the cell says, I'm toxic here, I'm damaged beyond repair, and the mitochondria basically say, yeah, we're committing suicide. So it's when the cell shuts itself down because it might be a danger to the other cells. Vitamin D may upregulate telomerase activity, and telomerase is the enzyme that replaces the telomeres and fixes them. It lengthens them, and we know of a couple of things that lengthen telomeres. The gene for that is called SIRT1, and resveratrol and all those red wine studies that were making the news a few years ago, resveratrol is another thing that will lengthen telomeres. Telomeres are probably also involved in immune-mediated inflammatory diseases such as autoimmunity. So if we take the vitamin D, it might prevent a point of leverage for prevention. There was less autoimmunity in the vitamin D group, so that supports that idea. Now, no study is perfect. Most of the participants were white, and all were at least 50 years old. So it's not generalizable. And the study didn't measure the serum vitamin D levels. It only looked at the telomeres. It may not have been powerful enough to feel that the omega-3s would have worked on telomeres. The dose of omega-3 they used at the 1,000 point, that's less than I generally recommend to people. I generally recommend 2,000 milligrams if you are at least if you're trying to prevent heart disease. I also tell anyone who has hypertension or a family history of heart disease that they need 1,000 milligrams, not of omega-3s, but of two of the subset omegas, which are EPA and DHA. So my advice to you is when you look at your omega-3, flip the bottle, look at the label, and see what your total EPA plus DHA is, and you want that to be 1,000. You might be taking four of the Costco brand omegas to get to that level. Another problem about omegas is you need to make sure they're not rancid, and rancid oil is bad for you because, drum roll, it's pro-inflammatory. So there's probably individual differences in what serum levels people get. Are they good fat absorbers? Are they bad fat absorbers? Do they have a gallbladder? Are they a high-stress person who doesn't have good pancreatic function and isn't digesting well? But another interesting thing, here's an unrelated study that looked at epigenetic clocks. This is a different way of measuring biological aging. And they found that under the same dosage scheme, 1 gram a day of omega fatty acids for 3 years slowed down biological aging across several of the epigenetic clock measures by up to 4 months. So they did see an effect on the omegas for that clock, but they did not see an effect on vitamin D3. So to me, it's like saying, well, if I have a pain from, let's say, muscle strain, I would want to take an anti-inflammatory, not an antihistamine. And unless I was having trouble sleeping, I might take the antihistamine. But the point being, different drugs have different effects on different body systems, and that's going to be the same for nutraceuticals as well. So as I've said, I recommend I tell my patients to take 4,000 or 5,000 international units of vitamin D, and then once a year I measure their levels to make sure they're not above 100. And I've never had anybody get up above 100 on 5,000 units. I've had them get above 100 on 10,000. So I don't recommend 10,000 for the general public. Maybe for a short period of time if you're really low, but 10,000 is about the most that the human body can produce after a long day in the sun, and since which tells me that that's the amount that the body is built to handle, because it's the amount it's built to produce. If that's the case, then you're probably safe staying under the biological doses. Just like with iodine, we have a natural experiment in Japan. The people are taking up to 4 milligrams of iodine a day if they eat a diet high in seaweed, and we're not seeing thyroid suppression. We're not seeing diseases that would be reasonably associated with iodine. So I think 3 milligrams or even grazing the bottom of 4 milligrams a day is very evidently probably okay. And I think we need to learn from nature, look at nature, and let nature teach us a little bit of, you know, what the thresholds should be, what is achievable by eating things or by being in the sun is probably safe. When you start megadosing, well, then you're in uncharted territory, and you'll often fetch up on an underwater reef and put a hole in your boat. The debate over the efficacy of vitamin D is ongoing and fierce, and future studies will help illuminate the ways in which it may contribute to health and optimal function. Current guidelines, which are, in my opinion, behind the science, do not recommend empiric vitamin D supplementation above the current daily recommended amount to lower the risk of disease, that is to say, deficiency disease, in healthy adults younger than 75. But evidence continues to accumulate that daily moderate doses of vitamin D may indeed impact the physiologic processes that lead to aging, inflammation, and autoimmune disease, and possibly even cancer, and that serve as the underlying causes of many of the conditions that cause chronic disease. So let's get some sun. It's summer. Don't get burnt, but a nice temporary pink blush, what's called the minimum erythematous dose, usually for a light-skinned person who doesn't have a tan, you know, that's 15 minutes before 11 a.m. or after 3 p.m., plenty to get a little bit pink, but the next day, you're not burnt. That's the dose. But of course, if you overdose, you won't know for a while, and you've done some damage. So I say a little bit of sun every day to maybe your upper body, maybe your back and your arms, if you can manage it, but not too much. Just do it every day. And you probably don't even need to take supplementation if you do that. Okay, our next story, and I guess let's start with this is a proof of concept on something that has never, ever been shown before, that we have always thought that sex at birth, that is to say your genitalia, is entirely determined by genes. It turns out that basic nutrition plays a role. And it's been known for a long time that severe iron deficiency in a mother can have deleterious effects on the development of the fetus. And this has been reported in the literature, lots of mice and rat studies, incomplete neurologic development. And in cases of humans with iron deficiency who give birth, the children often have behavioral and social problems later in childhood that, interestingly enough, mimic the effects of lead poisoning. And when you step back from that for a moment, it makes perfect sense, because one of the ways that lead poisons you is it poisons you by displacing iron from its basic functions, kicking it off the receptors, kicking it out of the enzymes, and deactivating those important biological mechanisms. And there is no time where the biological mechanisms are more vulnerable than in this incredible process of gestation of an embryo from one cell to this multicellular animal. In mammals, there's a genetic disorder that can occur in infants who are born genetically male, XY, but who develop ovaries due to the presence of a gene called SYR. The gonads begin to form at about 6 weeks of development, but if the SYR gene is absent, they become ovaries. Or if the SYR gene is there and you are an XY, then the ovaries are suppressed and they become testicles. So when the iron concentration in the mother, and these are mother mice, when the iron concentration is reduced by 60% at the cellular level, the SYR gene switches off. And when they reproduce this iron deficiency in a pregnant female who is carrying males, they observed something very interesting. About a sixth, that is 6 out of 39 of these XY offspring, were born with two ovaries, a complete sex reversal. One of the other mice was born intersex with one ovary and one testicle, a case of arrested development if there ever was one. So this gene triggers the development of gonads. A ferrous iron is essential for for various oxioreductive, we like to say redox because that's too hard to pronounce, reactions, including DNA demethylation. And the root here of the SYR is histone demethylation is required for normal epigenetic regulation of that Y chromosome sex-determining gene, SRY. So if you don't demethylate the histone because you don't have enough iron, then you don't turn on this particular thing that causes the ovaries to become testes instead. And chelation of iron in cultured gonads, they started out with just cultured gonads, and they found that it reduced the level of a particular compound that is a histone deacetylator. Now, I talk a lot about methylation, and I've talked about histone before, but they're usually described as like an empty spool of thread, and the spool of thread is built to have thread wrapped around it and not fall off, right? So the edges are flared, and a histone looks very much like a spool of thread, but what gets wrapped around it is the chromosomes. So when the chromosomes are being stored, they're stored in such a way that they're wrapped around these histones. And in order for particular compounds to be made, you have to unwrap the histones, and you do that with histone demethylation, or sometimes called deacetylation, but it's really the same idea. You change the shape of the DNA so that it can be unzipped in that location and transcribed into messenger RNA, and then find its way out of the nucleus and out to the ribosomes, where a protein product is produced, or in many cases, the messenger RNA can be broken up and used to do things because it itself becomes a signal. And that's the microRNA. And we now have some microRNA therapeutics that are emerging. We have gotten down to the alphabet. We're deciphering the Rosetta Stone here, and we are editing it because we now have the tools to do all three. And put those back into a mother and grow something or not. So the implications of this, I think, are really interesting at a time when we're all working to get our minds around this idea of mismatches perhaps between the genetics and the phenotype. And this is not in this study, we're looking at something that's easy to look at, genitalia. But I also think when I think about that, I also think, well, what's going on in the brain? And is this a factor in what is emerging in our society, which is, you know, a different way of thinking about a rift between, you know, chromosomal sex, and now we have evidence that the chromosomal sex and the genitals can mismatch, and we've seen rare cases of that in humans, and that's at the genitalia level. Again, easy to look at, but where we aren't looking, and where I hope someday we'll get the answer to this, is what's going on in the brain. I think I've come to the conclusion that, you know, you should believe the woman, and you should probably believe the person when, if she says that she's being harassed or she says that, just start with the default that she's telling the truth and investigate, okay? But don't assume that she's making it up as your baseline premise. I think we've all gotten there with the Me Too movement. Well, maybe when we start talking about sexuality and perceived self gender, maybe we should believe the person as our default. And then we may want to, you know, look for evidence, look for persistent behavior patterns, look for a history. We may want to be careful with, you know, I don't have a problem with puberty blockers, honestly. And the reason I don't is because it has a 30-year track record of success in people with precocious puberty. And they are now, you know, 30-year-old fertile adults. So it was fine to delay puberty. So I think that's the compromise position at the moment until we have more data. And that's what I'm proposing. And I don't mean to be political. I'm being scientific here. And I'm saying, what is the humane, compassionate thing to do when, and this may be the thing. It needs to be studied. It needs to be discussed in a calm, rational, non-political fashion, because we now have tools to do things. And we want to make sure that we follow the first rule of the Hippocratic Oath, which is first, do no harm. So let's talk about the accidental chance to do a lot of good. Let me tell you about something that happened. I came across this in the news. A woman collapsed on an escalator at the Buffalo airport last June. And a man named Phil knew exactly what to do. He and another bystander put her flat on her back and checked her pulse. She stopped breathing, and they started CPR. And someone nearby called 911 and then ran to a red-boxed automated external defibrillator. Do not be afraid of the boxes. You see them in every airport. Actually, they're all over the place, but airports are the only place where they've been actually put where you can see them. And that's a really important thing. We'll be getting to that. Within seconds of receiving a shock from the AED, the woman opened her eyes and she was conscious, talking, of course, was taken to the hospital. But the point was, she would have been brain damaged or dead if the CPR and the defibrillator hadn't been right there. So getting certified as an emergency medical responder, we should be teaching this in high school. We're giving out Narcan for a reason. We can teach the kids this, and it would be for a reason. The trick with a cardiac arrest is to do it in a public place where bystanders know how to help you and there is an AED that can be located. More than 350,000 cardiac arrests occur outside a hospital setting in the U.S. In 9 out of 10 cases, the people dies because help doesn't come quickly enough. The ambulance can't necessarily get there. Every minute that passes without intervention with an AED drops the risk, the odds of survival by 10%. If they can get that shock immediately, you can triple their survival odds. And fewer than half people get immediate help of any kind. About 70% of cardiac arrests occur at home. But even a public place, it takes about 8 minutes on the average. So that means it can be a lot more, particularly if you're in a rural area. It takes 8 minutes for emergency personnel to arise. That AED shock The machine talks to you. It walks you through it. Even if you have no clue what to do, clear instructions. And, you know, kind of on the turn this fire extinguisher upside down, pull this pin and point it at the fire. You know, stuff like that. You put pads on the patient's chest where it says to put the pads. If you have a cardiac arrest in a public place, AEDs currently are used 7% of the time and CPR 42% of the time. So we need to be able to find those AEDs. And there's a company, a national foundation called PulsePoint. They also run, have an app which allows you to listen to fire alerts. All the fire people use it. It's registered 185,000 AEDs in 5,400 communities in the U.S. And the idea is to set up a national registry for where the AEDs are. I have an AED in my office. I haven't registered it. I had no idea this was a thing. I'm going to find them and register my AED. Through a companion app, people who are trained in CPR can volunteer to be alerted to any potential cardiac arrest within a quarter mile of where they are when calls come in to the 911. And the app also identifies registered AEDs nearby. So you, too, can be the person who saves Jane Doe or John Doe two blocks away. Maybe it's your neighbor. Maybe it's someone in the supermarket with you. All 50 states and Washington, D.C. have good Samaritan laws that protect you from legal liability if you intervene in a medical emergency in good faith. Training? Well, most of us haven't received CPR training at all, and only 18% report that they've received it within the last 2 years. And you need a refresher to maintain your skills. And by the way, how to do CPR does change as the research tells us more. There are other countries that prioritize this for many, many years. Finland, for example, Denmark, such training is required to get a driver's license, and middle schoolers are also trained. Norway provides this kind of training. Since 1961, they've been doing first aid training in primary school, teaching you how to stop bleeding, teaching you to splint things, and mandating CPR training to receive a driver's license. 90% of their population is trained in CPR. So just to remind you, you have to push really hard on the mannequin's chest, a depth of 2 inches, and you want to be on the sternum and not on the ribs, and you want to do 100 to 120 compressions a minute. That's 2 per second. Bump, 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 bump. So the old Bee Gees song, that was what I was taught, is hum that to myself and go with the beat. Staying alive, staying alive. It's easy to remember. And yes, that is what you are doing. You are helping someone stay alive. So I hope that my little community service announcement inspires even just one person out there to download the app and gain the skills and maybe someday save a life. Pay it forward, right? Let's move on to a surge in vasectomies, which has popped up. The Supreme Court's overturning Roe versus Wade appears to have caused many Americans to rush to get a snip. Rates of vasectomies have surged 95%, doubled, in men aged 19 to 26. Tubal ligations rose 70%, mostly in red states, which have enacted abortion bans right and left. We're seeing a major change. It's also, I might add, happening. It is the law of unintended consequences, right? Part of the political drive to build the coalition against abortion was the idea that we're not at population replacement, and so we're not having enough babies. I might add that maybe it's babies of a certain race, but whatever it is, so let's prevent people from having abortions. And instead, what you did was get a whole bunch of people sterilizing themselves on purpose to not have babies because they either don't want them or have already got them in sufficient quantity. So, boy, did that one ever backfire. We're going to pivot just a minute and go back in the not-so-far way-back machine to January of 2025, when we had in our local area a very big and very smoky battery fire at a place where there were lithium batteries. So a bunch of lithium did go up into the air along with polyvinyl chloride and plastics and anthracyanidins and all kinds of the nasty stuff that's in plastic and building materials. So we're all kind of cringing a little bit locally, wondering, you know, has it gotten into the water? Has it gotten into the air? And then, of course, you have the devastating wildfires in Los Angeles. And all of the stuff that's relatively safe and inert in your home goes up into the atmosphere and then rains down onto the land and then gets into the water. And wildfire smoke is already causing, we estimate, 500,000 deaths a year worldwide. And that's climbing as the forests burn, but particularly the incinerated debris of urban life, chemically treated furniture, plastics. Here's something that I knew because I had a house fire in 2017, and it was a small contained fire, but it burnt a lot of plastic. Even homes that aren't destroyed by a nearby fire can harbor toxins the smoke brought inside, particularly in rugs, sofa, and drywall. The pink flame retardant that's used to tame wildfires leaves behind cadmium and other heavy metals. And all of it is noxious. So I went to the water quality site in Monterey and took a look at the soil report and the water report for the areas around that Moss Landing fire. And, you know, I will say that to the extent that I could understand them, they looked reassuring. The debate has been, you know, how was the sampling done? Does it really reflect the burden in the soil? And those of you who were listening to this program back when the fire was going on will remember that the first thing I said was, it's going to get into your garden soil. If you grow your vegetables, you need to you need to scrape off the top layer of soil before it rains. A couple inches will do. You'll get most of the crap. I don't know how many people took my advice. I took my own advice. And the point is that plants concentrate things, and particularly metals. And so the level in the soil may be acceptable, but the level in the plant may not be. I'm not saying don't eat your organic produce, but I am saying we are continuing to poison our environment, and it's no longer in our control. I mean, it used to be factories burning things. Now we don't want the buildings to burn. We don't want to burn the things, but they're burning anyway. So one of my big hobby horses for the health of my community over the next few years is going to be household fire safety, because those firestorms get rolling because the flames and embers get up against the house. And so I'm going to have to change my beautiful landscaping, and I will weep for the trees, but I will do it, because if you and I and your next door neighbor and their next door neighbor actually make their houses more resistant to fire, it can make a huge difference. Some of the fire resistant homes that were quote unquote fire hardened in the LA fires didn't burn. Everything around them did, and it wasn't just a fluke. They were designed to be hard to catch on fire, and you know what? The technology worked. So please look into that and educate yourself, and you'll be doing everyone a favor because, you know, as they say in the old 1970s song, the air, it's everywhere. Well, I have a young relative visiting me who comes with a dog attached at the hip. And I have to say that I am just so enjoying having a dog around me. There's just something. I love my bunny, and my bunny is very sweet, but just a little moody, and she doesn't have that kind of presence that a dog has for me. Owning a it turns out statistically that researchers from Britain's University of Kent drew on data from a nationally represented survey looking at British households, and they asked them, well, how satisfied were they with their lives? It turns out that living with a cat or a dog to cuddle was associated with an increase of 3 or 4 points on a scale of 7, with 1 being miserable and 7 being perfectly content. The team also used a technique devised by economists to translate intangible assets, such as living near a park, to monetary worth to reach an equivalence of a $90,000 a year boost. Now, that's above the average income for the United States. And I think most of us, except for the very rich, would be really happier if we had $90,000 more dollars a year. It basically said that one pet that you love is worth the same amount of increased satisfaction and happiness with your life. There are also similar cash values with other social activities, like catching up with friends once or twice a week. That also was had a great value, similar in equivalence to having a pet. And, you know, something that's outside of you, for which you have regard and which has regard for you, someone to live for. And I certainly am seeing that, because when I have patients or even myself, you know, it's like, well, will my pet be okay? I do care about that pet. It is family. And so you can get the benefits of family without the freight that goes along with getting along with your relatives. And so having a pet is a really good idea. And we have lots of longevity data that supports that. What else do I have for you in the 5 minutes that remain? Let the kids sleep in. Children who get as little as 15 minutes of extra sleep a night have measurably better cognitive performance than their peers, a new study suggests. Fitbit trackers of about 4,500 tweens between the ages of 11 and 14. The participants were split into three groups: the worst sleepers, who clocked in at 7 hours and 10 minutes, the best, who managed 7 hours and 25. Doesn't seem like a very big difference. Really a small difference, but the best sleepers markedly outperform the others in assessments of vocabulary, reading comprehension, problem solving, and focus. They had larger brain volumes and slower nighttime heart rates. So this is correlation. We don't know if the larger brain and the slower heart rate helps you sleep, or whether or not staying up an extra 15 or 20 minutes of video games at night. Well, it's possible, but again, it's a good study because it's statistically significant, but I'm not sure it's clinically meaningful, and I'm not sure we aren't confusing the longer sleep with some X factor that also contributes to the better academic performance and the better physiological markers. Certainly, brain size is not shown to correlate really very well with intelligence as a general rule. So I don't think it's just the brain size making them sleep more, and that making them smarter. But something's going on here. And again, it needs to be studied further. And I think we need a better instrument than a Fitbit to do it. And it needs, I think the first thing I would say about this research is that somebody's got to replicate that. It was done in China. Let's replicate the thing in another country. Let's make sure that it is actually a thing and not a statistical coincidence. And then let's study it, because there might be some real information in there that would be useful. So we talked earlier about vitamin D in telomeres, and we talked briefly about another study looking at omega-3 fatty acids and indicators for cellular aging, biomarkers, if you will. The biomarker race to find a biomarker that is really good, that correlates well, that's easy to test, that's cheap to test, and that has solid data supporting that it is a biomarker for cellular senescence and aging, would allow us to test senolytics, which is to say drugs that are known or thought to delay cellular aging, in a much more systematic fashion, right? You need those, you need biomarkers, and then you can really test your drugs and see if they lower the biomarkers. So cellular senescence occurs when cells stop dividing, but do not trigger that apoptosis mechanism that would allow them to die naturally. Instead, they hang around, and they're kind of stuck in a zombie-like state, and they create signals which are pro-inflammatory in nature and kind of poison the goldfish bowl for the cells surrounding them. Mayo Clinic researchers recently identified interleukin-23 as a significant biomarker of cellular senescence and aging. In other words, one of the things given off by these senescent zombie cells that can be easily tested. It meets those criteria. It's in the bloodstream, easy to get to. It doesn't require you just look for it with an immune-linked absorptive column. So ELISA testing, which has been around for 30 or 40 years, and age-related diseases like autoimmune disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other metabolic disease, pulmonary fibrosis, and other pulmonary diseases, deterioration of the nervous system. IL-23 seems to be a solid cross-the-board tissue marker for aging. They actually went through 92 different plasma proteins. The tissues involved included kidney, liver, spleen, brain, fat, and one of the things they also did in these studies was they used drugs that clear senescent cells. Now, most of these actually have somewhat toxic effects. A lot of them are used in chemotherapy, but they have adverse side effects. But quercetin, which is a very safe agent, research shows that 1,000 milligrams a day will actually help clear this IL-23. Fisetin was the strongest agent, and that's a bioflavonoid, again, an antioxidant, found in high levels in strawberries, apples, and onions. And luteolin, 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day, that's a carotenoid, also a strong antioxidant. And all of these reduced this tissue marker. So, again, you know, I'm in favor of tonic supplements supporting the system, eating right, eating lots of fruits and vegetables. You're going to get a lot of this stuff along for the ride. I take a lot of supplements, and I am, N of one, so I can never prove anything. But I'm doing remarkably well. Happy to say so. So far, so good. And I do know that eating right and exercise is not as hard as the food industry makes it seem, but you do have to learn to cook. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.